So this is a process talk. Since it's right after lunch, I'm going to speed through some of the slides to keep you from falling asleep and to get us back on time for questions. What I'd like to do is kind of tell you how we get to our recommendations, so you understand that we don't just sit around and make them up. That's important to us at the task force. And I'm starting with the slide that I wrote probably almost 8 years ago now that describes what we are: independent panel of nationally recognized non-federal experts experienced in primary care prevention, evidence-based medicine, and research methods. There are 16 task force members, 8 women, 8 men. Two members are advanced practice nurses, one is a behavioralist, and the rest are physicians. We're charged by Congress to review the scientific evidence for clinical preventive services and make evidence-based recommendations for the healthcare community. And I start with this slide to point out that nowhere on the slide does it say secret government death panel. We have invested a lot of time and effort into creating an explicit process for developing recommendations, and the steps are all on a single slide, so I would like to go quickly through those and talk about a couple questions in specific. We define the question about the preventive services within an analytic framework, and I'll show you one of those in a second, but it's the way we organize the way we think about prevention. We then work with the evidence-based practice center to define and retrieve the relevant evidence, judge the quality of each study, and then kind of judge the overall body of evidence for these key questions that are embedded in the analytic framework. We use a set of critical appraisal questions that many of you will recognize from your epidemiology days. Then we synthesize the body of evidence across the key questions and make a judgment about this certainty of net benefit, where net benefit is a balance of benefits and harms. Ultimately, we link the magnitude and certainty of net benefit to a letter grade or recommendation statement, which actually has some meanings and implications for practice. The one thing I want to point out is the number of times you see the word judge appear in the process. There isn't like some innate quality that says this is evidence-based. Ultimately, you have to judge the quality of a study and the criteria we use to do that. And ultimately, we as a task force have to judge the certainty of net benefit. And so while we try to apply, and we do apply, I think, this system in a very strategic and hopefully transparent and consistent way, regardless of the topic, it does make it possible for two groups of well-intended, good scientists to look at the same body of evidence and come up with slightly different recommendations. So I think that's an important thing to point out at the beginning. We do try to define this question in a primary care setting, and the outcomes of interest within this analytic framework that talks about key questions and this chain of evidence. This is an analytic framework and the one that we really use for looking at services. And so here you start with persons at risk, and the best study would be this key question number one: is there direct evidence that screening reduces morbidity and mortality? The best setting for that key question or direct evidence would be a randomized controlled trial based on invitation to screen. That minimizes the biases, maximizes the ability that you have an unbiased estimate of the effect size. If that's all we did, we would have a very short portfolio, because there are just not enough RCTs on the screening tests that are widely available to do only randomized controlled trials. So we can build a chain of evidence that screening leads to early detection leads to either an improved intermediate outcome or directly to reduce morbidity and mortality. And then finally, if we look at an intermediate outcome, the association is strong. So that would be establishing the chain for effect. And then for harm, we pull off the adverse acts of screening and the adverse effects of treatment to allow us to look at the adverse effects and the benefits and make a balanced statement. Here's the way the key questions go. So what's the prevalence of disease? Does test detect the largest condition, the target condition? Does treatment reduce intermediate or final outcomes? Do we have reduced morbidity or mortality at the end, and then what are the adverse effects? In judging quality, any of those of you who've ever done evidence grading or looked at Cochrane or other settings or EPCs know that you talk about good quality as high internal validity using these evidence-based practice center criteria. Fair quality is there always some minor threats to the internal validity, and poor quality is it's really such a bad study you can't come to a confident conclusion. These are the critical appraisal questions we use for each key question and then the entire body of evidence. Appropriate research design, high quality, internal validity would be all those things. Did the randomization work? Were outcome assessments blinded? All the things you learned in study design. To what extent are the studies generalizable to the U.S. population? It's interesting, in the evidence-based world, this is an area where we're still a little bit in our infancy in judging how a study in say, Sweden or Denmark really applies to a much, much more diverse and heterogeneous community like the United States. How many studies and how large have been done to answer the question? That is, do we really know with good precision about the evidence? Consistency, and then other factors supporting the conclusion. So we ask ourselves these questions for each key question. And then we judge the evidence as either convincing, adequate, or inadequate. And convincing is a pretty high bar. Several high-quality studies, consistent logical results that are generalizable to the U.S. population. Adequate is something less than that. And poor is that you really can't come up with a strong evidence base. The task force then estimates magnitude of benefit, magnitude of harm, and estimates the difference between those two, and then applies that across the entire body of evidence across each of the questions. This certainty is an interesting word. I usually like to define certainty as the opposite of risk of being wrong. So high certainty means I have a very low risk of being wrong. And you see in the slide it says conclusion is unlikely to be affected by future studies. So high certainty, low risk of being wrong. Great example would be hypertension. Hypertension will always be an A recommendation. There will always be strong evidence base that screening almost at any age and treatment leads to decreased cardiovascular and stroke outcomes. Moderate certainty is kind of this in-between. We believe there's enough evidence and enough of a low risk of being wrong that we can get off the dime and make a recommendation. But it isn't as strong, and there is at least some risk that future studies might change. And then low certainty is basically a toss-up. We really can't get off the dime. There's just not enough evidence to assess effects on health outcomes. And that's where we think the risk for a new study really changing the game would make sense. A great example we're now facing is lung cancer screening currently has an conclusion for insufficient evidence, which would be low certainty, and would remain an I until we have a good randomized controlled trial that screening for lung cancer reduces mortality. There's a preliminary release of results from the spiral CT studies that looks very encouraging, so that could move us off the eye. The task force uses this grid then to ultimately sign a letter grade, and you see on one axis is the certainty of net benefit, high, moderate, or low, and on this axis is magnitude of net benefit, benefits minus harms, a substantial, moderate, small, or a zero negative. And then you fill in the rest of the grid. The only way to get an A is to have high certainty of a substantial net benefit. There are three ways to get a B such that there's at least moderate certainty of a moderate net benefit. C, two ways to get a C, two ways to get a D, which is no net benefit or even harm, and then insufficient evidence at the bottom. We worked very hard with primary care physicians to translate these into clinical directions, and we tried to simplify it that A and B's would be do, C D's would be don't do, and I's would be don't know. This language, recommend against use for C, was very carefully templated. Believe it or not, those Three words took a year of debate, and I'd like to say we got it right, but we found out with mammography that maybe those weren't the right words. But the concept in working with the docs was really pretty clear. It was really to say this shouldn't be routine. You shouldn't pull the forearm off. You actually need to, oh my gosh, be a clinician. Look at the patient in front of you and make a decision based on their values, their individual risks, other things you know about the patient in a shared decision-making format. And unfortunately, recommend against routine use didn't really pull that off as we had hoped. And we're still thinking about the best language around Cs. Notes that a C is not, it doesn't say it doesn't work, doesn't say it does harm. It says it provides small net benefit. I statement's a conclusion, not a recommendation. We need more research. I say it does not mean the intervention is not effective. It means there's no evidence of effectiveness, not that there's evidence of no effectiveness. And that's a very clever play, well, I think it's clever, play on words, that are very different statements. It just says we don't know versus we know it doesn't work. And I always point out with the eyes that there's a possibility of clinically important benefit, but we need more work. We got criticized for not having experts. We have a lot of experts. These are our partners who review all of the things that we put together, the family physicians, the internists, the OBGYNs, the pediatricians, NIH, CDC, CMS, the VA, and the Association of Health Plans. So these folks give us input and help us hopefully keep from making the wrong decision and better tailor our messages. We also use relevant specialty organizations and send out our work products at several points to revise. What we've added to this now is a public comment period, which we think is going to slow us down, but we think increases our transparency and hopefully will help us make better messages that people understand, and we don't suffer from purposeful miscommunication and misinformation as we did last November. I like the process. I think it creates recommendations based on evidence. The process is transparent, explicit, protects against politics, economics, and advocacy, and gives primary care clinicians a standardized set of recommendations. Now, confidently be expected to improve the health of patients. When I look at the mortality numbers from states, I've done it about five times now, and analyze them, about 50% of the deaths every year in every state would be addressed by one of the A or B recommendations. The cons, there's no systematic consideration of patient values, it's expensive, time consuming, the most common grade is an I. We don't get direct questions on periodicity or when to start or stop, and I will tell you it doesn't work well in rare diseases. The A's and B's for average risk adults can fit on one slide. And these address 50% of the deaths in every state. This is a good set of recommendations. So cervical cancer, CRC screening, the letter grades are different ages and different starting areas and different modalities. Breast cancer, that's the cancer cluster. The next is the heart disease cluster, hypertension, lipids, obesity, and tobacco. And then the rest is everything else, chlamydia, osteoporosis, depression, and alcohol misuse. There is a list for high-risk adults that has additional issues on it I'm not going to cover in the interest of time. So I can end on the Affordable Care Act. A and B recommendations will be provided with first dollar coverage representing the floor for preventive services. So what that means is two things. One is you can cover a lot more than the A's and B's. They're the floor, not the ceiling. However, they will be covered with first dollar coverage, which means no out-of-pocket costs. So that really raises the awareness and the investment in prevention. We can have additional coverage recommended by the HHS secretary, and in fact, Congress amended ACA to assure that coverage for women for mammography under 50 was a covered service. I will tell you that 16 out of 16 task force members said, we agree with that. This was not about coverage. This was about small net benefit and discussing that with women. So that's it.